Okay, I'm going to give you the Mahasachika Sutta. Sachika was basically a troublemaker. He liked to go where people were giving talks and then argue with them. And he was very good at arguing and with different people and making them mad and making the leaders of groups look bad. And he tried to do that with the Buddha a few times, that it didn't work. Okay. Thus have I heard on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Visali in the great wood, in the hall with the peaked roof. Now on that occasion, when it was morning, the Blessed One had finished dressing and had taken his bowl and outer robe, desiring to go to Visali for alms. Then Sachika, the Nigantha's son, Nigantha Naputa was very much like Sai Baba. He did magic tricks and things like that. He would do this and there would be ash coming out of his palm and that sort of thing. Okay, Sachika came to the hall with the peaked roof in the great wood. The Venerable Ananda saw him coming in the distance. So Ananda saw him coming in the distance and said to the Blessed One, "Venerable sir, here comes Sachika, the Nigantha's son, a debater, a clever speaker, regarded by many as a saint. He wants to discredit the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. It would be good if the Blessed One would sit down for a while and out of compassion." The Blessed One sat down on a seat made ready. Then Sachika, the Nigantha's son, went to the Blessed One and exchanged greetings with him. When this courteous and amiable talk was finished, he sat down at one side and said to the Blessed One, "Master Gotama, there are some recluses and Brahmins who abide pursuing development of the body, but not development of the mind. They are touched by bodily painful feeling. In the past, when one was touched by bodily painful feeling, one's thighs became rigid. One's heart would burst. Hot blood would gush from one's mouth, and they would go mad, go out of one's mind. So then the mind of the subservient to the body wielded mastery over it. Why is that? Because the mind was not developed. But there are some recluses and Brahmins who abide pursuing development of mind, but not development of body. They are touched by mental painful feeling. In the past, when one was touched by mental painful feeling, one's thighs would become rigid, one's heart would burst, hot blood would gush out of one's mouth, and one would go mad. So the body was subservient to the mind, and the mind wielded mastery over it. Why is that? That's because the body was not developed, Master Gotama. It occurred to me, surely Master Gotama's disciples abide pursuing development of mind, but not development of body. But Sachika, what have you learned about the development of the body? Well, there are, for example, and he gives three or four different teachers. Some of them go naked, rejecting conventions, licking their hands. After they eat with their hands, and when they got done, they would just lick the hands to clean them instead of wash their hands. It's really kind of nasty. They do not accept food brought or food especially made or an invitation to a meal. They receive nothing from a pot, from a bowl, from across a threshold, across a stick, across a pestle, from two eating together, from a pregnant woman, from a woman giving suck, from a woman in the midst of men, from where food is advertised as being distributed, from where a dog is waiting, from where flies are buzzing. They accept no fish, no meat. They drink no liquor, wine, or fermented brew. They keep to one house, one morsel. They keep to two houses, two morsels. And then it goes all the way up to seven houses and seven morsels. They live on one saucerful a day. They live on two saucerfuls, on three, and all the way up to seven. They take food once a day. They take food once every 2 days. They take food once every 3 days. They take food up to once every fortnight. They dwell pursuing the practice of taking food at stated intervals. But why do they live on so little, Satchika? No, Master Gotama, sometimes they consume excellent hard food, excellent soft food, excellent delicacies, drink excellent drinks, whereby they again regain their strength and fortify themselves and become fat. I met a monk in Malaysia. He was an American, and he would only eat once every 2 weeks, one time. But when he ate, he would eat so much that it was unbelievable. And I asked him, "Why are you doing that?" He said, "Well, if you don't eat so much, you don't have lust arising in your mind." And I said, "That's a little radical, don't you think?" And it is against the rules for monks to do that. But he continued doing it, at least for a period of time. And I suspect he was just experimenting. But that's not a good way to experiment. What they earlier abandoned, Satchika, they later gather together again. That's how there's increase and decrease of this body. But what have you learned about the development of mind? When Satchika, the Nigata son, was asked by the Blessed One about development of the mind, he was unable to answer. Then the Blessed One told him, what you have spoken of as development of the body, Satchika, is not development of the body according to Dhamma in the Noble One's discipline. Since you do not know what development of the body is, how could you know what development of the mind is? Nevertheless, Satchika, as to how one is undeveloped in body and undeveloped in mind, and developed in body and developed in mind, listen and attend closely to what I shall say. Yes, sir, Satchika, the Nigantha son replied. the Blessed One said this, how Satchika is one undeveloped in body and undeveloped in mind. Here, Satchika, pleasant feeling arises in an untaught ordinary person. Touched by that pleasant feeling, he lusts after pleasure and continues to lust after pleasure. That pleasant feeling of his ceases. With the cessation of the pleasant feeling, painful feeling arises. Touched by painful feeling, he sorrows, grieves, and laments. He weeps, beating his breast, and becomes distraught. When that pleasant feeling has arisen in him, it invades his mind and remains because body is not developed. And when that painful feeling has arisen in him, it invades his mind and remains because mind is not developed. Anyone in whom, in this double manner, arisen painful feeling invades his mind and remains because body is not developed, and arisen painful feeling invades his mind and remains because mind is not developed. This is the undeveloped in mind and undeveloped in body. And how Satchika is one developed in body and developed in mind. Here, Satchika, pleasant feeling arises in a well-taught noble disciple. Touched by that pleasant feeling, he does not lust after pleasure and continue to lust after pleasure. That pleasant feeling of his ceases. With the cessation of the pleasant feeling, painful feeling arises. Touched by a painful feeling, he does not sorrow, grieve, and lament. He does not weep, beating one's breast, and become distraught. When that pleasant feeling has arisen in him, it does not invade his mind and remain, because his body is developed. And when that painful feeling arises in him, it does not invade his mind and remain, because his mind is developed. What are we really talking about here? We're talking about developing a mind that has equanimity in it, not grabbing onto anything that's pleasant and holding on to it and saying, that's the way it's always going to be. And when painful feeling arises, not pushing it away. Now, this is also talking about the definition of craving. Craving can be recognized as tension and tightness in your mind and in your body. Where in the body? There's a membrane that goes around your brain. It's called the meninges. And it also goes all the way down around your spine. When you see this tightness in your head and you relax, you're affecting your mind and body. And you're relaxing. Craving is the I like it, I don't like it mind. As I was talking about yesterday, you have five aggregates. You have a physical body, you have feeling, pleasant feeling, painful feeling, neither painful nor pleasant. You have perception. Perception is a part of the mind that names that feeling. A pleasant feeling comes up, your mind says that's a pleasant feeling. Painful feeling arises, your mind says that's painful. So what I'm showing you here is something that is not noticed by most people that do meditation. Now, there's actually just two different kinds of meditation. There's a lot of different styles of this. But one kind is what I call one-pointed concentration or absorption concentration. Now, meditation that's generally taught by most people, your mind is on your object of meditation. It doesn't matter whether it's the breath, or you're staring at a candle, or you're staring at something. Your mind gets distracted. As soon as you notice that distraction, your instructions are to let go of that distraction and immediately come back to your object of meditation. Now, this is a meditation that, as you keep going deeper into meditation, this style will suppress hindrances when they arise. The force of the concentration stops hindrances from coming up. And you get a feeling of, they call it bliss, happiness. Your mind is not disturbed at all. It just stays on your object of meditation. Now, the problem with this is when you lose your concentration, there is no personality development. You're not able to recognize the hindrances with your daily activity. So there's no change in your personality. You get just as mad as you got before. You get just as much lust coming up as you did before. You get caught by your restlessness. You get caught by dull mind. And these hindrances, when they get suppressed, they're just pushed down. You're not letting them go. When you practice TWIM, what I'm showing you now, there's one extra step. That extra step is the relaxed step. That's why I talk a lot about the six R's. The six R's is right effort. When you're on your object of meditation and your mind gets distracted, you let go of the distraction, relax the tightness caused by that distraction. When you're relaxing the tightness, what are you doing? You're letting go of craving. Right after you relax, you'll notice in your mind, you don't have any wandering thoughts. You don't have thoughts at all. Your mind is clear. Your mind is very observant. And your mind is pure. Why is your mind pure? Because you've let go of the false belief in a personal self. Okay, that is the biggest problem with people that are doing meditation. They talk about not-self. They don't know what not-self actually is. And you won't know it and be able to recognize it until you see that tightness and relax. Then you have to bring up something wholesome. And I say, bring up a smile. Why? The more you smile, the better your mindfulness becomes. And again, mindfulness is remembering to observe how mind's attention moves. And I'm not talking about just while you're sitting. I'm talking about all the time. So what do I want you to do? I want you to smile all the time. When you smile, your mind has a tendency to have more and more joy arising. when you have joy in your mind and a hindrance comes, you can see your mind starting to get hard and tight. So it's much easier if you get in the habit of smiling all the time to be able to recognize that. Now, it's a real interesting thing that I've read many books on the five hindrances, and they're always talked about as being part of the enemy. Somebody you have to force down, you have to stop the hindrances from coming up. But the hindrances, if you read the Satipatthana Sutta, it's the first thing that's mentioned when it's talked about mind objects. They're a natural part of this practice. If you're practicing one-pointed concentration and a hindrance starts to come up and the force of the concentration stops it from coming up, you're going off of the path that the Buddha taught. Everything in Buddhism is about doing this with your mind. Everything is about opening up and allowing, except when there's flies bothering you. Well, I'll come up with a solution for that pretty soon. You can catch them and have them go, put them outside. So, when a hindrance comes up, it arises because of past actions that you've done. When I first came to this country, after being in Asia for 12 years, nobody like to talk about the hindrances and the cause of the hindrances. The cause of the hindrances is breaking one of the precepts. It's really important that you understand this. When you break a precept, every time you break it, your mind says, "I shouldn't have done that," very quietly. And you have a feeling of guilt coming up. And you can suppress it pretty easily. But when you sit in meditation, all of a sudden these hindrances start coming up and they can get pretty strong. They arose because of breaking precepts. And we've been around for a long, long time. We've been around for thousands and thousands of lifetimes of being ignorant of how this process works. So we've broken precepts for many, many thousands of lifetimes, and they'll come back at you eventually. And you can have anger come up. You can have a lot of lust coming up. You have a lot of restlessness. You have dullness of mind. You have doubt whether you're doing things correctly or not. These are called hindrances because when they arise, you're not on your object of meditation anymore. You're not practicing true mindfulness. Now, remembering to observe how mind's attention moves by using this definition of mindfulness, you're actually starting to go much deeper into your understanding of this process. When you start seeing what happens first, what happens after that, what happens after that, you start becoming more and more familiar with this psychophysical process as a process. that's nothing personal. What makes things personal is breaking a precept, having the little remorse, I wish I hadn't have done that, having a kind of a guilty feeling, and taking it personally. This is where the idea of I comes from breaking the precepts. So when you take the precepts, it's not just, oh, it's only morality, we don't have to pay attention to that. You have to understand you're hurting yourself by breaking a precept. You're causing yourself all kinds of problems. And in this country, they say that about 60% of the people are taking some kind of drug because of a mental problem. Why do you have mental problems? Because you broke precepts. It's that simple. Can't be that simple. Well, yeah, it can. When you're practicing the six R's, you're learning how to recognize the beginning of I am that. That's what craving is. I like it, I don't like it, I am. That's lust, hatred, and delusion. It's another way of describing craving. When you relax that tension and tightness caused by that past action, you're letting go of that guilty feeling. You're letting go of that hindrance. You're letting go of the idea of everything that happens to me is me. It's mine. It's who I am. When you see the craving and you recognize that it's there and you relax, there is no more taking it personally. There's seeing things actually as they are. This is an impersonal process. Now, it sounds like it's a philosophy, but as you go deeper in the meditation, you'll see for yourself there's nothing philosophical about this at all. This is the way it actually works. So when you have a pleasant feeling come up and you take it and you try to hold on to it, I like it, I want it to stay around. One of the fastest ways to make the pleasant feelings go away is try to hold on to it. And it makes your mind tight. So this process that I'm showing you of smiling, it helps your mind have joy in it. And when you have a hindrance arise, you'll see your mind starting to get hard. Joy is one of the awakening factors. It's a real necessary part of the practice. And it's not something that most people will talk about. When I was in Burma, every time I had joy arise, I was told very frankly, don't get attached. It's okay for joy to arise. Actually, it's preferable to have joy arise. Then when your mind starts to lose some of that mindfulness, that observation of how this works, you'll start catching it more quickly, and you'll start relaxing more easily into it. And this purifies your mind. That's the whole point of doing meditation. Now, I wrote a book called Life is Meditation, Meditation is Life. There's no part of your life that you can't use mindfulness. Remembering to observe. When your mind starts to get tight because something is happening and you relax into it, you're starting to purify your mind. That hindrance, although it might not go away right away, it gets weaker every time you let it be. And you don't take it personally. You're starting to see more and more clearly how this process works. And this process is the links of dependent origination. This is a process of cause and effect in a very, very fine way. The Buddha described craving as fire. Okay? Every time you let go of the craving, you are experiencing no more fire. The fire is out for a moment. Nibbana. It's a pretty popular word. People like to think that they can attain it, and they can. But some people are saying, well, you can't attain Nibbana. It's going to take you 1,000 lifetimes. No sense in even trying right now. But every time you let go of that craving, you're putting out the fire. Ni means no, bana, fire. Now, there's two kinds of Nibbana. This gets very confused. Everybody thinks there's just one kind of Nibbana. But there's two kinds. It's a mundane Nibbana. When you use the six R's, you're putting out the fire for just a moment. You bring that lack of heat, the cooling, mind to a wholesome object, smiling. Smiling is not just here. Smiling is with your mind. Smiling is with your eyes. Smiling is with your heart. And there's a little smile. So it's not just a thing that you can paste on your face and say, I'm smiling, when you can have a lot of hatred in your mind. Because when you're truly smiling, you've let go of that heat and your mind becomes cool. When your mind becomes cool, it becomes more clear, more alert. And it starts to be more and more fun. One of the biggest problems that I have with a lot of students that come is they want something to happen in a particular way. And that right there, that causes big problems, because I want. Do you know what's going to happen next? Do you know what I'm going to say next? Well, then why try to project what you're going to hear next or do next? In the last few years, I've gotten into the habit of telling people, before you sit, every time you sit, tell yourself, I don't know what's going to happen next, and it's okay. Yeah, but I want Nibbana. That's the fastest way to make it disappear. So you have the mundane Nibbana, and you have the super mundane Nibbana, otherworldly kind of Nibbana, where it's a cooling that happens so much that there's real personality change that starts to happen. Every time you use the six R's, you're letting go of a little bit of heat. The super mundane Nibbana, there is no heat at all. It'll last for a period of time like that. And because of that, you won't break precepts on purpose. Now, I was just talking with somebody today about a lot of people have ideas that once you attain Nibbana, you're going to have all these fireworks happen in your mind, and then you're just going to be a completely different person. I am a saint now. But it's not like that. It's a letting go of the false belief in a personal self. It's seeing things as they actually occur without trying to project what happens when you want it to happen. Your mind becomes more open and free, and your expectations of what you want in life, they just start disappearing, because now you're truly living, and every aspect of what you're doing can be free from craving. And when it's free from craving, that means there's no more fire, and you become more balanced in your mind. Equanimity is a very important part of the Brahmaviharas. And equanimity is something that happens every time you get into or experience a jhana. There's different degrees of equanimity as you go deeper. And you have more balance in your mind. As you have more balance in your mind, everything becomes easier. You start to see the importance of not breaking a precept, not causing yourself problems. We cause our own suffering. You can't blame anybody or anything else for your suffering, because you do it to yourself. You have an expectation of the way you want things to be, and it doesn't happen that way. And then your mind gets upset. Now you have the hindrances to work with. Being able to recognize that tension and tightness in your mind, not only while you're sitting, but while you're eating, while you're taking a shower, while you're going to the bathroom, while you're walking from here to over there. Watch what's happening with mind. That's true mindfulness. Observe how mind's attention moves away from being in the present and relaxing into that. I've had some students that they were really into practicing this with sitting, but then they'd get up and start doing other things, and they'd become angry because something happened. And they'd say, well, I released and I relaxed and I released and I relaxed and I released and I relaxed and it doesn't work. Well, if you're not going to use the whole formula, of course it's not going to work. It's like trying to make a cookie without, well, I put the sugar in, and I put the flour in, and I put the sugar, and I put the flour, but it doesn't come out as cookies. Well, doesn't that make sense? You have to use the whole formula. You have to follow the directions exactly if you want that result. So they would come to me and they say, well, this meditation just doesn't work because I released and I relaxed and I still had the same amount of anger. Well, okay. You can torture yourself that way because you're expecting things to happen the way you want it to. You're taking it personally. You're not actually relaxing. You're trying to force a relaxed step because I don't like it. I don't want it to be this way. Instead of having that equanimity of saying, yes, it's there. Sometimes it's a pleasant feeling, sometimes it's a painful feeling. Okay, so what? It's the same coin, different sides. You have to treat it in the same way. Allow it to be there. Don't take it personally. Don't try to control. That's one of the biggest things I saw when I came back from Asia, is people, especially in America, are very much goal-oriented. I want to be successful. I want to do it and really do it right. And it doesn't come out that way. And then they get all emotional and upset. And they cause themselves immeasurable amounts of pain and suffering. So, what to do? A painful feeling arises. Well, yeah, that happens. I stub my toe. I step on a rock with my bare feet. Yeah, it's painful. So, do you have to get angry because that pain is there? Do you have to curse and have all of these bad feelings come up and attack you because you don't like this painful feeling? Or can you accept the fact that it's there? Yeah, it's painful. When a painful feeling comes up with your daily activities, you have to learn to start sending loving and kind thoughts into that pain. Don't resist it. Don't try to push it away. Accept the fact that it's there. I have a wood-burning stove. And this is the time of the year I use it fairly often. And sometimes you're putting in a piece of wood, another piece will fall down and you get a burn. And what I learned was, as soon as that pain came, I noticed that it was there. And instead of getting mad because it was there, I would start forgiving that pain for being there. And when that happened, the next day I would look and I'd have a red mark where that pain was. It wouldn't blister. And the day after that, it would be gone. So I started experimenting. Sometimes I would forgive it, sometimes I wouldn't. I'd just try to ignore it. If I tried to ignore it, that pain would blister. That little burn would blister and it would stay for a week or 10 days. But if I started putting forgiveness and loving kindness into that pain, by the next day, I forgot about it. I didn't see it, and there's, oh, yeah, that's right, I burned myself. There'd be a red mark, but it didn't cause any long-term negative effect. We have to be able to learn to do that with everything. Put loving kindness into the things that you don't like. Somebody says something that you don't like. What happens in your mind? How many times do you start wars with that? I don't like this. You're not doing it right. You're not doing it the way I want you to. If you don't partake in the dislike of it and have compassion for yourself and the other person that's throwing their anger at you in one way or another, and you start sending them loving and kind thoughts, their mental upset starts to go away very quickly. And then you can have real conversations about what the problem is. Because most of the time, what somebody gets angry at you about isn't for real. It's made up in the other person's mind, and they built themselves up. That painful mental feeling comes up, and it causes so many problems for them that they have to, quote, vent it and give it to you. Well, they can try to give it to me all they want. I'm not going to accept it. That's their problem. I can love them, and before long, they forget about it. Forgiveness meditation is probably the most powerful meditation that I know. You have to be able to forgive yourself when you make a mistake. Not criticize yourself. Not come down on yourself. A result didn't happen the way you think it should be happened. Why do you get angry at it? Didn't work. Okay, let's try something new. Learn from your mistakes. Put love into your mistakes. Put love into all of your mental dissatisfactions. And that means, this is an interesting thing that I was talking about today too. I have a student that's in Russia, and I've been teaching him on the internet. And he had written a book in Russia about the fall of Russia and what happened after the fall and all of the pain and suffering that people went through, and became very famous because he wrote this book. And he was holding a real tight mind about some of the things that happened to him as he was growing up, and I suggested that he do forgiveness meditation. And his English is pretty good. It really is very good. But he said, in Russian, we don't have a word for forgiveness. And I thought that was kind of interesting in itself. So I said, well, you got to come up with a word that, where you can open up and relax and not be hard on yourself. And he said, we have a word in Russian for acceptance. So he started doing that, and he was very successful, and he let go of a lot of the pains and suffering that he'd gone through in his life. He's now teaching in Russia, and he's using that as one of the main meditation objects. But that's what forgiveness is. It's about accepting mistakes. Accepting the fact that something happened in the past and there was pain, and you held on to the pain and didn't like it and blame somebody else for your pain. But when you start learning how to accept the fact that this is a dream, it's something that happened in the past, doesn't have anything to do with right now. Why are you still holding on to this anger about something that happened 50 years ago, 40 years ago, 20 years ago, yesterday? Why hold on to this stuff? Learn how to accept that life is going to have painful moments and it's going to have pleasurable moments, and don't get attached to either one. And you'll start to have a deeper and deeper satisfaction happen in you. An acceptance. A letting go of that fire. Letting go of the craving. Having that balance. And that's a very important part of what the Buddha was teaching us. Being able to recognize that tension and tightness in your head, in your mind, and relax that tightness. It doesn't matter what you're doing. When you recognize it, use the six R's right then. Now, the key word for mindfulness is really remember. Remember to observe. Remember that you're getting caught by this or that. Remembering that there's some dissatisfaction and dislike that happens. And then let it be and relax and forgive that dissatisfaction for being there. Don't get your mind into the criticizing mode. Okay? We criticize ourselves way, way too much, and we cause an awful lot of our own suffering, and we have to learn to stop doing that. And as you begin to accept the fact that, yep, I blew it, I made a mistake, okay, forgive that. Forgive yourself for making a mistake. Forgive yourself for causing pain to someone else, and continue on. As you turn that into a habit, everything in life becomes easier. Your mind becomes more luminous, lighter. Your mind becomes more radiant. And that's what Nibbana is all about. Having the radiant mind. Having the uplifted mind. Letting go of that criticalness. That hardness towards yourself. Because we are our own worst enemies. We cause ourselves an awful lot of suffering. And it's not necessary. It's just old habit. And we have this idea that that's the way life is supposed to be. But it's not. Life is supposed to be fun. When you were 3 or 4 years old, what was life like? Oh, it's wonderful. I love being around 4-year-olds. They have the best minds. They ask the best questions. And they have the best sense of humor. And they fall down and they start crying, and then before long they're up and they're happy again. Why did we change? Who was it that came around and said, okay, you can't have fun anymore. Now you're supposed to be serious. Because life is serious. And you have to worry about this and you have to worry about that. Well, I'd like to get a hold of that guy and shoot him, whoever said that. But we do it to ourselves. Because we start taking things personally. And we keep on criticizing ourselves if we don't meet our own expectation. As you start to truly go on the spiritual path, you start letting go of these expectations. Now, you can just be in the present moment without expecting the next moment to be the way you want it to be. And life starts to get to be fun again. So many times you hear, they call them Dhamma talks, about suffering. Oh, all everything in life is suffering. Dukkha, 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 dukkha. Well, there is suffering in life. That's true. We don't always get what we want. That's true. But that doesn't mean that you have to suffer because of it. The Buddha's teaching is about how to let go of the suffering. Not about how hard life is. When you start truly practicing with the six R's, there's a lightness that happens in your mind and in your body. And everything, I'm watching this nonsense with the political things that everybody was saying to each other about how nasty they were, and that was like a cartoon. I was laughing at that stuff because they were really trying to verbally stab daggers at each other. And it's a joke. Who pays attention to that sort of thing? Really? How much pain do you cause yourself because somebody says something you don't like? Or accuse you of something that you didn't do, you didn't have anything to do with it, but they want to accuse you of it. Laugh with it. No big deal. Why get over serious about this? It's all a bad joke. So you laugh with it. You smile with it. There's no sense in getting upset because of one philosophy or another. You have your own philosophy. You use six R's. Keep your mind in balance. Doesn't matter. Wait and see what's going to happen. Who knows? Why argue with somebody else because they don't agree with what you say or think? Why do you need to argue about that? I mean, the ceiling can fall any moment. Why don't you worry about that instead of argue with somebody else about whether it will fall or not? It just doesn't matter that much. If you want to affect the world around you in a positive way, you have to use the six R's and radiate loving kindness. I'm seeing major changes in some of the countries that I go to, that I've been going for a while. I'm seeing not only changes in the people that are coming to practice, but their families and their friends. And I'm seeing their minds get softer, and I'm seeing them appreciate things more, and I'm seeing them have lighter minds. Well, if you want your world to be fun And to get along with people, it has to start with letting go of the craving. Letting go of all of those opinions that you want to argue with other people about. Doesn't matter. It's only words. It's only philosophies. Philosophy is a lot of words without any action. What I'm trying to show you is have that action. Send loving kindness to people that are being disagreeable. Don't take it personally. And what happens? Then you start walking around and people start smiling back at you. When I moved to where I am now, it's a small town. It's about 1,200 people, 1,400 people, something like that. And I would go into town and they would see me with my robe on and they were very much afraid of me. But you go in, go to a restaurant, get something to eat, get something to drink. And the people that I'm with were giggling and laughing about nothing in particular. And they hear that. And before long, they come up and they start talking. Now, this is a place where it's a small town in Missouri. And they are very cliquish. If your family has lived in this town for 20 years, you're considered still an outsider. But now I when I go in to get some food or eat or get something to drink, people come up to the table and start talking. They sit down and talk with us because I'm not trying to convince them of anything. But they feel the happiness coming off of us. And they said, yeah, I want some of that. And they get to laugh with us. That's changing the world around you. Not arguing because of one philosophy or another. I don't care whether they're Baptist or Catholics or whatever religion they are. I don't care. They're human beings. And we have to remember to let go of our ideas of what we think it should be like to being in the present and being happy right now. So it's a real important aspect of the Buddha's teaching to recognize that every time you let go of that craving, you're changing the world around you in a small way. But over the years, it starts to build. And then everybody around you starts to become more happy around you. Right now, we have people from all over the world writing emails to us because they want to do online meditation retreats. And they're very curious because they see the YouTubes and it sounds good, so they want to try some of it. And this is affecting the whole world, not just part of it. It's not only affecting this small area, it's helping other people to realize that happiness for themselves. And it's starting to be that the people that do online retreats are starting to really understand that they have the responsibility for their own happiness. You can be sad, you can be happy. It's your choice. I prefer laughing to crying. makes my body feel good to laugh. So I laugh. And the more we can understand that we are the world, we affect everything around us. You have the choice of affecting it negatively or positively. So the more you can understand that loving kindness means lovingly accepting what's happening in the present moment and giving love away. Smile and give your smile away. Practice your generosity in this way. You are following the Buddha's teaching. One of my favorite sayings is, if you take care of Dhamma, Dhamma will take care of you. And it's, life starts to get more and more magical as you start recognizing letting go of that tension and letting go of that tightness in your mind and practicing it with your daily activities. When you come to our center, we have you doing a job every day, whether it's helping in the kitchen or garden or doing one thing or another. That doesn't mean that you forget what you're doing with the meditation. We have that job period so you can practice doing these things with an uplifted mind, with a happy mind. It doesn't matter whether it's cleaning toilets or not. It doesn't matter whether it's pulling weeds or chopping vegetables. The more you smile into these things, the better your mindfulness becomes, the more you start to turn everything into a good habit. And you start noticing how other people will soften when they see you. You'll start to notice this. And life truly does start to be great fun. Doing this practice all the time. Recognizing when a hindrance arises and let it be and relax and smile and wish well to yourself or someone else. Eventually you get to a place where people can come up to you and they can be extremely angry. And your mind just, okay, they're angry. That's their problem. Now what to do? As you accept the fact that there's painful times and joyful times and they're going to arise, and that's the way it is with life. That's why being a human being is so important, because we have these ups and downs. We have these tests all the time that we have to go through. As you take care of the Dhamma, what's happening in your own mind, Dhamma will take care of you. And quite often, I use that as an example for, there are times when there's not so much money coming into the center and we're going to be running out of money and all of this kind of thing. And the people come to me and say, oh, we've got all of these problems. I don't know how we're going to have to close. And they tell me that. And I said, okay, don't worry about it. It's no big deal. I'm not going to worry about it. I don't ever worry about money. Why? Because it comes. Don't cross your arms. This is a thinking posture, not a listening posture. Okay. Then somebody comes along and they donate some money. They donate the support. We don't ever have to worry about that sort of thing. Oh, we got a neighbor that's mad because you did something. You cut down some trees that they really liked. Or we did something that they didn't like. They come to me and all worried. No problem. If they're mad enough to come and talk with me, by the time they leave, they're smiling. They've forgiven whatever slight thing we've done. Sometimes we want to put a road in where people don't want a road. But we want it there, so we go ahead and put it there. And they, oh, you shouldn't have done that. So what? It's fine. There's no problem. If you're really upset, well, cover the road over again. I don't care. If it's such a big deal to you. We have to have this equanimity, this balance of mind that doesn't get caught up in the emotional ups and downs of life. And you can affect people around you when you radiate equanimity to them. Now, going to be coming for interviews tomorrow. We're going to start at 9 o'clock and go until you're done or I'm done, whichever the case may be. If you've been here and you've done a retreat and you did the 6 directions and radiate to all beings in all directions. If you've been doing that, that's the way you start. But if your mind starts to change a little bit, and instead of loving kindness, it changes to compassion, or it changes to joy, or it changes to equanimity, whatever that feeling is, that's what you use as your object of meditation. So don't hold on to any one of the Brahma Viharas, because we actually go beyond equanimity. So don't even hold on to that. Don't try to force your mind to say, well, I'm practicing loving kindness, but I don't feel any loving kindness coming out. Well, fine. What feeling are you feeling? Go with that. It's real important for you to understand that this is a natural process. It happens by itself. As you continually use the 6 R's with any distraction, you'll start sitting for longer and longer periods of time without any distraction. And you can sit for a half an hour, 45 minutes, an hour, without any disturbance in your mind at all. There's a lot of relief in that. One of my senior students, she's a very energetic person. And she's, when I first met her, she was doing, what do they call it, multitasking all the time. And as she started to get more calm and she started to have more equanimity in her mind, she said, I can't multitask anymore. Now I just do one thing at a time. I said, you're a lot more efficient now, aren't you? Well, yeah. But she didn't cook and watch TV and have a conversation and be on her cell phone all at the same time. She just can't do that sort of thing anymore. And that is a really good thing. And she got to a place where she could sit with just having her mind silent without any distraction at all for an hour. And after an hour, her mind said, well, there's nothing happening, so I'm going to get up and do something. And it drove me crazy. Stop doing that. Don't break the sitting when it's good. When your sitting is good, stay with the sitting. That's it. It took 3 years for me to convince her to stop doing that. And when she did, all of a sudden her progress in the meditation zoomed. I accused her of being adrenaline junkie. She had to have adrenaline. She had to have some excitement going all the time. And when everything settled down and there was no excitement, she got bored with it. And that started to happen in Indonesia. A lot of the students would come to me and say, I'm bored. And I told them, who's bored? Who lost their mindfulness? Who doesn't like having quiet all the time? And finally, I had to make that one of the banned words. You can't tell me you're bored anymore. So now they say it's the B word. And I've told them last year, I told them that that's saying the same thing. Your mindfulness is gone when you're bored. Who's bored? Who's taking it personally? Who wants something exciting for their mind to do? Who's not accepting having a peaceful, calm mind? And when you get into that state where your mind is very peaceful and calm and it stays on your object of meditation, even if your meditation object is mind, and it stays there for a long period of time, that's when your mind is most pure. You don't have any craving in your mind at that time. The craving arises when you're bored. And they're starting to get it. They're starting to understand. Another of the banned words that I have is, I'll try. No, you don't try. Either do it or don't do it. There is no try. And the last of the banned words is, yes, but. I said, get your butt out of the way. I don't know. There are no buts in Buddhism. There's either doing it or not doing it. There's no excuses. One of the reasons that I really got into meditation and Buddhism was because of the self-responsibility. You're responsible for everything. Can't make up excuses. You have to accept what you're doing while you're doing it and follow the directions precisely. So one of the reasons that I wanted to get into this sutta was because OK. Okay, this is the story about the Buddha before, while he was still only a bodhisattva, and he was in search of Nibbana. Here before my awakening, while I was still only an unawakened bodhisattva, I thought, household life is crowded and dusty. Life gone forth is wide open. It's not easy while living in a home to lead a holy life utterly perfect and pure as a polished shell. Suppose I shave off my hair and beard, put on the yellow robe, and go forth from the home life into homelessness. Later, while still young, a black-haired young man endowed with the blessings of youth, in the prime of life, though my mother and father wished otherwise and wept with tearful faces, I shaved off my hair and beard and put on a yellow robe and went forth from the home life into homelessness. Having gone forth, monk, in search of what is wholesome, seeking the supreme state of sublime peace, I went to Allura Kalama and said, friend Kalama, I want to lead a holy life in this Dhamma and discipline. Allura Kalama replied, the venerable one may stay here. This Dhamma is such that a wise man can soon enter upon and abide in it, realizing for himself through direct knowledge his own teacher's doctrine. I soon quickly learned the Dhamma as far as mere lip reciting and rehearsal of his teachings went. I could speak with knowledge and assurance, and I claimed I know and see, and there were others who said likewise. I considered it is not through mere faith alone that Allura Kalama declares by realizing for myself with direct knowledge I enter upon and abide in this Dhamma. Certainly Allura Kalama abides knowing and seeing this Dhamma. Then I went to Allura Kalama and asked him, friend Kalama, in what way do you declare that by realizing for yourself with direct knowledge, you enter upon and abide in this Dhamma? In reply, he declared the base of nothingness. I considered not only Allura Kalama as faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration and wisdom. I have faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration and wisdom. Suppose I endeavor to realize the Dhamma that Allura Kalama declares he enters upon and abides in by realizing for himself with direct knowledge. I soon quickly entered upon and abided in that Dhamma by realizing for myself with direct knowledge. Then I went to Allura Kalama and asked him, friend, is it in this way that you declare that you enter upon and abide in this Dhamma by realizing for yourself with direct knowledge? He said, that is the way, friend. It is in this way, friend, that I enter upon and abide in this Dhamma by realizing for myself with direct knowledge. It is a gain for us, friend, it is a great gain for us that we have such a venerable one for our companion in the upon and abide. So the Dhamma that I declare and enter upon and abide in by realizing for myself with direct knowledge is the Dhamma that you enter upon and abide in by realizing for yourself with direct knowledge. And the Dhamma that you enter upon and abide in by realizing for yourself with direct knowledge is the Dhamma that I declare I enter upon and abide in by realizing for myself with direct knowledge. So you know the Dhamma that I know, and I know the Dhamma that you know. As I am, so are you. As you are, so am I. Come, friend. Let us now lead the community together. That's a really high honor. Thus, Alora Kalama, my teacher, placed me, his student, to be on equal footing with himself and awarded me the highest honor. But it occurred to me, this Dhamma does not lead to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to awakening, to Nibbana, but only to the reappearance in the base of nothingness. Not being satisfied with that Dhamma, disappointed with it, I left. He was practicing one-pointed concentration. Okay. Still in search, monks, of what is wholesome, seeking the supreme state of sublime peace, I went to Udaka Ramaputta and said to him, friend, I want to lead a holy life in this Dhamma and discipline. Udaka Ramaputta replied, the Venerable One may stay here. This Dhamma is such that a wise man can soon enter upon and abide in it, himself realizing through direct knowledge his own teacher's doctrine. I soon quickly learned the Dhamma as far as mere lip reciting and rehearsal. I could speak with knowledge and assurance, and I claimed I know and see, and there were others that did likewise. I considered it is not through mere faith alone that Ramaputta is son of Rama. Okay, so he went to his son to ask him, but his son had not gotten as far as his father had gotten, but he knew all of the philosophy behind it and how to teach. By realizing for myself with direct knowledge, I entered upon and abided in this Dhamma. Certainly Rama abided knowing and seeing this Dhamma. I went to Udaka Ramaputta and asked him, friend, in what way did Rama declare that by realizing for himself with direct knowledge, he entered upon and abided in this Dhamma? In reply, Udaka Ramaputta declared the base of neither perception nor non-perception. That's as high as anyone can go when they're practicing one-pointed concentration. Okay. Why? They can't go any higher because they're not purifying their mind enough by letting go of the craving, by seeing the craving and letting it go. I considered not only Rama had faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom, I too have faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. Suppose I endeavor to realize the Dhamma that Rama declared he entered upon and abided in by realizing for himself with direct knowledge. I soon quickly entered upon and abided in that Dhamma by realizing for myself with direct knowledge. Then I went to Dhamma Ramaputta and asked him, friend, was it in this way that Rama declared that he entered upon and abided in this Dhamma by realizing for himself with direct knowledge? That is the way, friend. It is in this way, friend, that I also enter upon and abide in this Dhamma by realizing for myself with direct knowledge. It is a gain for us, friend. It is a great gain for us that we have such a venerable one for our companion in the holy life. So the Dhamma that Rama declared he entered upon and abided in by realizing for himself with direct knowledge is the knowledge you enter upon and abide in by realizing for yourself with direct knowledge. And the Dhamma that you enter upon and abide in by realizing for yourself with direct knowledge is the Dhamma that Rama declared he entered upon and abided in by realizing for himself with direct knowledge. So you know the Dhamma that Rama knew, and Rama knew the Dhamma that you know. As Rama was, so are you. As you are, so was Rama. Come, friend, now lead this community. So he was willing to take a step down. He had gotten to the realm of nothingness, but he didn't want to go any further than that, because he had a very strong belief in reincarnation and God and these kind of things. When you get to neither perception nor non-perception, you see that that doesn't work. That is a philosophy. Then Uddhama Ramaputta, my companion in the holy life, placed me in a position of a teacher and accorded me the highest honor. But it occurred to me, this Dhamma does not lead to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation. Why? Because there's still craving. To praise, to direct knowledge, to awakening, to Nibbana, but only to a reappearance in the base of neither perception nor non-perception. Now, if you don't go any further than that in this lifetime, you will be reborn in a realm that lasts a long, long, long time. A Mahakapa is made into four different sections. They're called Asankhya. And Asankhya is an expansion of the universe, and then it stops for that length of time, and then it contracts for that length of time, and then it stops for that length of time. So there's always universes that are being reborn. The length of time you spend in this realm is 84,000 Mahakapas. That's a long, long, long time. But it is a pleasurable realm. So, still in search, monks, of what is wholesome, seeking a supreme state of sublime peace, I wandered by stages through the Magadhan country until I eventually arrived near Uruvela. There I saw an agreeable piece of ground, a delightful grove with a clear flowing water with pleasant smooth banks. And a nearby village for alms resort. I considered this as an agreeable piece of ground with a delightful grove and a free-flowing water with pleasant smooth banks and a nearby village for alms resort. This will serve for striving for a clansman intent on striving. And I sat there thinking, this will serve for striving. It doesn't say it in the suttas, but this is where I very strongly suspect the Buddha came up and figured out how the links of dependent origination worked. He spent a fairly long time at this site doing meditation and figuring out how this process actually does work. But just because he figured it out didn't mean that he realized it. And he had to practice, and then seeing that it was actually true, this is the way it works. And there was no question in his mind at all. And finally, his mind just opened up. And this is the way it works. And he became the Buddha. Now these three similes occurred to me spontaneously, never heard before. Suppose there were wet, sappy piece of wood lying in water, and a man came with an upper fire stick, thinking, I shall make light and fire. I shall produce heat. What do you think, Satchika? Could a man light a fire, produce heat by taking the upper fire stick and rubbing it against a wet, sappy piece of wood lying in water? No, Master Gotama. Why not? Because it's a wet, sappy piece of wood and it's lying in water. Eventually, that man would reap only weariness and disappointment. Some kinds of meditation are like that, where you just get weary. You don't want to do it anymore. You quit. So too, Satchika, as to those recluses and Brahmins who still do not live bodily withdrawn from sensual pleasures, and whose sensual desire, affection, infatuation, thirst, and fever for sensual pleasures has not been fully abandoned and suppressed inwardly, even if, I don't like the word suppressed in this, I should have changed it. Let go of is better. Even if those good recluses and Brahmins feel painful, racking, piercing pain due to exertion, they are incapable of knowledge and vision and supreme awakening. And even if those good recluses and Brahmins do not feel painful, racking, piercing feeling due to exertion, they are incapable of knowledge and vision and supreme awakening. Why? Because they don't recognize craving and let it go. This is the first simile that occurred to me spontaneously, never heard before. Again, Satchika, a second simile occurred to me, never heard before. Suppose there were a wet, sappy piece of wood lying in dry land, far from water, and a man came with an upper fire stick, thinking, I shall light a fire, I shall produce heat. What do you think, Satchika? Could the man light a fire and produce heat by taking the upper fire stick and rubbing it against the wet, sappy piece of wood lying on dry land far from water? No, Master Gotama. Why not? That is because it's a wet, sappy piece of wood. Even though it's lying on dry land far from water, eventually the man would reap only weariness and disappointment. So too, Satchika, as to those recluses and Brahmins who live bodily withdrawn from sensual pleasures, but whose sensual desire, affection, infatuation, thirst, and fever for sensual pleasures has not been fully abandoned, even if those good recluses and Brahmins felt pain, racking, piercing feelings, due to exertion, they're incapable of knowledge and vision and supreme awakening. Again, that's because of this one extra step. And there's a lot of resistance to even trying this one extra step. This was the second simile that occurred to me spontaneously, never heard before. Again, Satchika, a third simile occurred to me spontaneously, never heard before. Suppose there were a dry, sapless piece of wood lying on dry land far from water, and a man came with an upper fire stick thinking, I shall light a fire, I shall produce heat. What do you think, Satchika? Could the man light a fire and produce heat by rubbing it against the dry, sapless piece of wood lying far from water? Yes, Master Gotama. Why is that? because it's a dry, sapless piece of wood, and it would be lying on dry land far from water. So too, Satchika, as to those recluses and Brahmins who live bodily withdrawn from sensual pleasures, whose sensual desire, affection, infatuation, thirst, and fever for sensual desires has been fully abandoned, even if those good recluses and Brahmins feel pain, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, they are capable of knowledge and vision. That again. Old habits, I know. That again is because they recognize the letting go of craving. In other suttas, and you'll get to hear these, it talks about the two main causes for suffering, craving and ignorance. What is ignorance? It's ignoring how the psychophysical process actually works. That means seeing and understanding how the links of dependent origination do occur. When you get to a certain place in your meditation, you'll start seeing that more in everything. In animals, you can see how they start to get hungry and their lust for food, and they start drooling and things like that. You start seeing how these links of dependent origination work in everything. And there's a lot of, wow, it really is true. It really does work this way. And when you start realizing that in deeper and deeper levels, the taking of things personally just starts disappearing by itself. The lust and the hatred becomes weaker and weaker and weaker, and finally it will disappear. When you get to the third stage of awakening, you no longer have fear of anything. You no longer have lust. And I'm not talking about sexual lust. I'm talking about lust for anything. For food. For trying to make things be so that you have more pleasure. And you don't have any hatred arising. Never again. What relief is that? It's worth working for. And your understanding of how dependent origination works becomes deeper, and you start seeing it more and more clearly. This is a process. It doesn't have anything to do with me. It's just the way things work. And there's a lot of freedom in that. There's a lot of a lot more joy arising, a lot more happiness as you go and you start letting go of these major hindrances. You're still going to have a little bit of restlessness, and you're still going to have a little bit of dullness of mind. They don't disappear until you become an arahat. Oh, well. So the thing is, as you go deeper and deeper into the practice, there is real personality change that starts to occur. When you become a sotapanna, the change that occurs is you're not going to break precepts on purpose. And there's a lot of relief in that. I had a man that came and he became a Sotapanna, and I was congratulating him, and he said, "I don't believe it." I said, "Okay." And there was a post sitting right beside me made out of wood. And I say, "Tell me that that's pink." And he couldn't do it. And he said, "Oh, my mind had all resistance to saying that." I said, "Well, that means you're not gonna tell little white lies. You're not gonna say things that aren't true. And you're gonna have resistance to breaking any of the precepts." And by the time he left, he was a real believer, let's put it that way. People have this idea that the experience of Nibbana has got to have all these fireworks going off and all kinds of wonderful things. And they tell me about their experience. I get kind of excited for them. "Oh, congratulations, you become a Sotapanna." "I don't believe it." "Well, okay, let's try to break a precept. See what happens." "Oh, my mind won't do it." "Well, that's one of the ways you find out." "Yeah, but I was expecting all kinds of great things and I wanted to be able to feel different. Because that's what I've been told. When you attain Nibbana, you're definitely going to be a different person." "Oh, you're going to be the same person. You're just not going to do unwholesome things as many. You can still have lust. You can still have hatred. When you get to the second stage, you're still going to have some lust and hatred, but it's not going to be as strong. And you'll catch it more quickly, and you'll let go of it because it's painful. And you'll see that in yourself. When you get to be an anagami and they don't even arise in your mind anymore, it's not that there's all these fireworks that happen, it's just that your mind doesn't grab on to favorite foods or demands that reality be a particular way or having sexual activity or whatever it happens to be. Your mind just won't be interested in it. And no more hatred, no more aversion, no more dissatisfaction. I mean, big. It's really big. And that changes and softens your personality even more. So it's not these fireworks that are going to be going off all the time. They don't. Sometimes they do. But for most people, they don't. Let's put it that way. But your perspective starts changing. You start seeing things more clearly. You don't have these old bad habits of saying things that aren't true and doing things that cause yourself more problems. You stop doing that. And your mind is more uplifted all the time. You don't ever have any doubt as to whether this is a real path or not. You know for sure that there is no personal self, but you can still have some craving. Craving doesn't disappear until you become an arahat. Even in an anagami, there is some slight bits of attachment. And that comes from pride of thinking, you know, I'm an anagami, I'm something special. I'm hot stuff. And there's still little bits of that sort of thing. But when you become an arahat, all of that disappears. And there is no more craving ever again to arise in your mind. There's no more ignorance. Ignorance is, there's, you see precisely how the links of dependent origination work in all aspects of your life. You don't have restlessness, a mind that doesn't get over agitated or try too hard. Oh, what relief is that? Or a mind that dulls out. That's the things that turn you into a saint. Ledi Sayadaw, he was a monk that, he was born in the 1800s and he lived to be, oh, I think it was in the 40s that he died, in 1940s. He was one of those kind of scholars that comes around once every 100 years or so. He's really something. He wrote over 100 books. I mean, he was really quite an amazing teacher that way. And he said that the Buddha era is the age of saints. And I like that, because you become, when you become a Sotapanna, the most lifetimes that you're going to have is 7. And after that, you're going to get off the wheel of samsara. The Buddha said of people that become a Sotapanna, you've given up an ocean of suffering. You're never going to be reborn in a hell realm. You're never going to be reborn in a hungry ghost realm or as an animal. The lowest rebirth you're going to have is as a human being. And you will, if you die from this and you're reborn as a human being from in this period of time, from the time you're a little baby, you will never break a precept. That's how strong this is. So you're never going to have any doubts as to, and for the whole rest of your existence, however many lifetimes you live, you're never going to have any doubt as to what the true path is. That's nice. And you're not going to believe that rites and rituals are going to lead you to Nibbana. They don't. And I have some students in Indonesia. A couple of them are anagamis, but they like to do chanting. And they said, do I have to give up chanting? No, you don't have to give up chanting. You like to chant? Chant. You just realize that it doesn't lead you any deeper in on the path. Chanting, they've too many different sects of Buddhism make that their main practice, chanting. Chanting Abhidhamma over and over and over again. I'm going to be reborn in this Brahma Loka, and from there I'm going to become off the wheel. Doesn't happen. There's all kinds of beliefs that if you do things in a particular way, then you're going to be enlightened. He was a Mahayana practitioner for 7 years. Every day he chanted the same chant. And he came and he talked to me when I was talking to him about Nibbana and that sort of thing. And He said, well, I've been doing this same chant for 7 years. Do you want me to do it for you? I said, yeah. So I listened to him chant. And I said, what did it mean? Mean? No, it's the vibrations of the chant. That's where you become awake and enlightened. And I said, you don't know what it means, so why don't you chant banana over and over again? At least you know what a banana is. It's the same thing. But there's this belief that these rites and rituals and doing things this way leads to nibbana. When you become a sotapanna, you know that it doesn't. And it's not bad chanting. A lot of the chanting is the different discourses of the Buddha. And that's why monks chant, because they want to keep that tradition going of they're supposed to know what they're chanting. And some of them do and some of them don't. In Burma, you better believe they do. They have, they're probably the most intelligent Buddhists for memorizing the suttas, all of the suttas. I had the opportunity to spend a couple of days, but not for long periods of time because he was sick, with a monk that had memorized all of the Buddha's teaching, 12,000 pages. Took a test on this. Now, you know you're in college and you have to go take a test and it's going to be 4 hours and you feel wrung out after taking the test. Oh, that was so long and it was so hard. He took a test 10 hours a day, 30 days in a row. And he got over 90% correct of everything that he did. He had a truly amazing mind. And I got to ask him the difference between what commentaries say and what the Buddha said. And there's, according to the way people are practicing straight vipassana right now, they say there's khanika samadhi, which they say is moment-to-moment awareness. There's upachara samadhi, which they say is neighborhood concentration. That's right before you get into deep concentration. And apana samadhi is deep concentration, one-pointed concentration. That's the way they practice. And I ask him about upachara samadhi and khanika samadhi. I said, I'd never ran across it in the suttas. Is it there? He said, no, that's commentary. Well, commentaries is one person's opinion about what they think the Buddha was talking about. And if it doesn't agree with the actual teaching, then I have a tendency to let that go. That's why the book is so important to me, because I want to read the sutta to you. So you know that it's not my ideas. It's coming from the Buddha. When I first started letting go of the commentaries and I started reading suttas to people that were doing retreats with me, all of a sudden I saw them jump in their understanding. Oh, that's what the Buddha said. And it was amazing to watch. That's why I started reading more and more. Because it's more important to get it as close to the actual teaching as we can get. I have some I have a tendency to change some of the words that are in the suttas because they don't agree. They're just harder to understand. Like the regular translation of vitaka and vichara, the first two parts of the first jhana. Traditionally, it is called initial application of mind and sustained application of mind. And what does that mean? I change it to thinking and pondering, and that makes it simpler to understand. So I do that with some of the things that I read, just so that it's an easier thing to understand. But to watch how people grow so much faster with this meditation than any other meditation I've been around, and I've been around a lot of meditations, to see people in 10 days go from never really understanding the teaching to deeply understanding the teaching because you have the direct experience and listening to what the Buddha says helps with your understanding, and as soon as you understand well, you'll start to realize it. It's real fun to be around. Well, in the last time I was in Indonesia, 60% of the people that practiced and followed the directions correctly became at least Sotapanna. 60%. I was amazed. That's a lot. But now I have a lot of students that are starting to go out and teach, and it's starting to pick up from there. And they don't need me to come to Indonesia anymore. This is the last year I'm going to go for a while. I might go back again, but not every year. I've been doing it every year for 7 years. And now I'm going to be going to other countries and starting the same way, doing the same things again. Anyway, the seeing and knowing, that's knowledge and vision, is talking about your direct experience. And as you, and you're going to start getting this starting tomorrow's Dhamma talk, as you start to hear more and more about dependent origination and how it works, you're going to start going much deeper, much more quickly into the meditation. I've told a lot of people that this is about being human being, and this is how the process works according to what the Buddha is saying. And it really does work this way. So, okay. Okay, that's enough. So, sit as long as you're comfortable. If you have meditation pain arising, don't give in to it right away. Sit for a little bit longer, because a meditation pain is mental. Even though you think, oh, it's my buttocks or my back or whatever, it's not
a real physical pain. It arises because of breaking precepts in the past. Either that pain will go away or it won't. If it doesn't go away, your mind will start to have more and more balance with it, and eventually it won't even disturb you. It'll just be a feeling that comes up. Six heart, let it be. Eventually it will go away, I promise. But sometimes it takes a while. So why don't we share some merit? May suffering ones be suffering free, and the fear-struck fearless be. May the grieving shed all grief, and may all beings find relief. May all beings share this merit that we've thus acquired for the acquisition of all kinds of happiness. May beings inhabiting space and earth, devas and nagas of mind,